All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am answering your questions about the All-22 of the Falcons Week 3 loss to the New Orleans Saints.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So, guys, I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for over a decade at FalcFans.com. You can find me on Twitter at FalcFans, and of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, I am answering questions from you, the listeners out there that sent them in on Twitter, email, Facebook, and whatnot. As usual, we do these Q&As, sort of breaking down the film and looking at sort of what happened this past week, but also, you know, some of the questions aren't necessarily film-based stuff, and it's just you guys trying to get my thoughts on a certain perspective or a certain topic. And if you are curious of where you can send in questions for the next time we do these, we're going to probably do these almost every single week, then you can do so on Twitter, at FalcFans. If it's podcast-related, if it's Q&A-related, just say so in the tweet. But it's easier to go ahead and send it to Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle. I automatically know it's more of a Q&A-related question if you send it there. If you prefer Facebook as your social media platform, that's Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. Of course, email address if you spurn social media like a good human. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is the email address. And, of course, you can leave a comment at FalcFans.com where the podcast is posted daily. So without further ado, let's jump right into it. We got an email from Andy, Mave2124, the New Jersey Falcon fan. He says, I was extremely surprised by the mic check column on the AJC Monday afternoon. It was almost as if Vic paid Cunningham to write the column, LOL. At first look, the pass rush looked awful against the Saints. Vic jumped off sides on his sack of Breeze, and there was little pressure on Breeze. Please let me know if the film review shows different. Was this actually all on shoddy back seven play, especially linebackers and safeties? Please break down the punt block and whose fault it was. Please break down how and why the Saints focused on run defense and let Ryan throw it on them most of the game. And despite the sting of losing a shootout to the Saints in Mercedes-Benz Stadium, we should hopefully be ready to play against Cincy and have a chance to win and get to 2-2. Time will tell, and it will be a lot of skies falling around the team this week. I counted 13 of the Saints 51 dropbacks in which the Falcons got some form of pressure. And a couple of times that was being a little generous in my eyes, but, the problem is that only four of those 13 times were disruptions. And what I count disruptions, I mean a sack, a hit, or pressure. And I distinguish between pressures and hurries because in my eyes, a pressure is basically when the rush causes an incompletion or forces the quarterback to scramble. Basically, I want to know how many times the pass rush actually stopped the offense from completing a pass, i.e. the goal of the defense on a given pass play. For 51 dropbacks, you want that number of disruptions to be at least double what it actually was against the Saints. I don't know if this is necessarily backed up by statistical data, but from years of reviewing games, my general rule of thumb from past years is that you want to disrupt roughly 15% of teams' pass plays, and that's sort of your benchmark for competency. It's really when you get up in the 20%, 25% or higher is when you're really starting to cook as a pass rush. For example, I counted the Eagles disrupting 13 of the Falcons, I think 48 dropbacks in that week one game, which is about 27%, and you contrast that to the 8% of disruptions that the Falcons had against the Saints. Looking at those disruptions, that one hit was by Poole on a blitz where he came unblocked. Oh, no, he didn't come unblocked. He beat Zach Line. Brooks Reed had a pressure. Trufant had a pressure when he was unblocked on the blitz at the end of the game. And Beasley had that sack that, you know, basically cheated to get that sack. Well, you know, we can't even give Big Beasley credit when he gets a sack. For what? But the other nine plays were hurries, and three of those were basically when the defender was unblocked. So, you know, that sort of tells you something right there. That four out of the 13 times the Falcons got some pressure, no one blocked the guy, and that's how they got pressure. But the Saints, you know, as far as sort of looking at the linebackers and safeties, the Saints regularly attack the middle of the field. That's been consistent these last couple of games, and I think it will continue to be consistent throughout the season. I think they were threw the ball as much as they did in part because they haven't had a lot of success running the football this year, and they're utilizing their sort of short dink and dunk passing game to sort of supplement the run game. As I think I've said before, a 5-yard completion on a pass play is just as good as a 5-yard run. The funny thing, though, is the Saints didn't really have that much trouble running the football against the Falcons. They had a success rate right around 50%. I might be off. It might be like 45, 48, 52 or something like that. I have to check my math. But something right around 50%, which is really good for those of you that not necessarily familiar with success rate. So basically anything north of 45 is where you want to be from a success rate running the football. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were so effective in short yardage situations later in the game as the game progressed. You know, part of the reason why the Falcons didn't get a lot of pressure is for those similar reasons, because Breeze gets the ball out quick, and with sort of their short passing game, you know, the ball's going to come out pretty quick. But that's part of the reason why I think you have to have an overwhelming pass rush in order to be effective against the Saints offense. And look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the back seven played well. They did not. They obviously missed tackles. They blew coverages. You know, guys were out of position. But from my perspective, I mean, in you know, others are more than welcome to disagree with me. But I think when you have basically four rookies and a journeyman backup playing in your back seven, you know, you're going to expect breakdowns. You're going to expect a lot of inconsistency. And when I say four rookies, I mean Olakun and Oliver got a lot of reps against the Saints. And you also have Riley and Casey, who barely played last year. And then your journeyman is Jordan Richards. So, you know, I expect the back seven to be pretty inconsistent, pretty erratic for the foreseeable future. And I think that's one of the reasons why I go so much harder on the pass rush, because I think they have to find a way to compensate for that, because you know that that back seven is not going to be good. You like, I mean, you just know that, like, you just know those things. Like, maybe in with more games under their belt, we, you know, by the time we get to week 8, week 9, week 10, maybe they'll start to actually play well, or maybe, you know, but like in the meantime, your pass rush is going to have to carry it, just like the offense is going to have to carry this team. And so if and when the offense starts to struggle, guess what? I'm going to spend 20 minutes on this podcast talking trash about the offense, because that back seven is a massive liability, and the rest of the team has to step up. You talk about next man up, and it's really about the other areas of the roster that aren't as hard hit as by injuries. The other areas of the roster that are supposed to be strengths of your team need to step up. You know, you can certainly say that, you know, I'm pushing a certain narrative when it comes to the pass rush, and I will certainly cop to that. I think we've seen, you know, you watch these Falcon games, and you see the Falcons late in games in the fourth quarter trying to move the ball down the field to get one last score to win the game or whatever. And guess what? The Falcons use their 5-man protections, and our offensive line gets whooped. Ryan Schrader got whooped by Cameron Jordan on the last drive. Mack struggled on that last drive. Schweitzer struggled on that last drive. You know, and the Falcons couldn't keep that Saints pass rush at bay as they were trying to drive down the field and get the game-winning score. Now, on the flip side, when you see the Saints in these 2-minute offenses, you don't see them struggling. It's why you go back years and you see Geno Smith driving his team down the field to win against the Falcons. Brian Hoyer driving his team down the field to win against the Falcons. You saw Tom Brady do it multiple times in the Super Bowl in the second half of the game. You saw Drew Brees do it this past Sunday. Like, why do you think that happens? Do you think it's because the Falcons have a good pass rush? You know, look, I know I'm probably preaching to the choir when I say a lot of these things, but like, part of the reason why I'm pushing this narrative about the pass rush is because this has been a problem for years. I've sat here and watched the Falcons have a mildly competent pass rush for just basically make up a number, and that's probably accurate. It's probably a lot more than the number that you're making up in terms of their pass rush. So yeah, I get a little fired up about it. Yeah, I the back seven is bad. We know that. Of course it is. But, like, you know, saying the pass rush is fine, it's like, come on. Like, seriously? So I get where you're coming from, Andy, because reading the column, I'm like, really? Okay. Like, really? That was my response to it. But moving on to your next question. The punt block was given up by Foye Olakun. He got beat by Alex Okafor. That was interesting, was that was the first snap I think Okafor had on the punt block team. He beat Olakun cleanly to the outside and blocked the punt. You know, hard for a rookie linebacker to block a guy that's basically was a starting defensive end last year. They got 5 sacks. So, you know, it happens. As for your last question, I don't know if the Saints quote-unquote focused on the run and quote-unquote let Matt Ryan throw on them. I think they just stopped the run because they executed well up front. I think their guys up front won their matchups. I don't think they were letting Matt Ryan throw on them. It's just guys in the back seven, particularly, you know, at that outside cornerback spot, didn't really execute what they were asked to do. The, you know, the Saints trust their guys to line up and play a lot of man coverage, and the Falcons burned them. Ridley burned Williams, burned Crawley, Jones burned Crawley. You know, I thought Patrick Robinson and Marshawn Lattimore both played well, played fine. I think Marcus Williams had some costly breakdowns and some deep throws that led to some big plays. So I think, you know, it's as simple as this. In the run game, their guys were better than our guys, and in the passing game, our guys were better than their guys. Now, we got more questions to come, but I want to let you guys know that Locked On NFL is becoming everyone's favorite daily national NFL podcast. Each week, you have a number of great guests joining host Matt Williamson to discuss all things NFL. On Mondays, it's the local experts on the biggest stories of the week. On Tuesdays, you can have a chat with former NFL quarterback Sage Rosenfels. Wednesdays, it's Mike Renner of Pro Football Focus. Thursdays, the great Mike Sando of ESPN. And Friday, make sure you get Matt's picks of the week. That's Locked On NFL Podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Now, if you listen to this podcast, you know, guys, I have most of the answers when it comes to the Falcons, except for in certain areas where I don't always have the answers, and that's often who's going to win, particularly the Falcon games, but also elsewhere in the league. But if you guys think you have those answers, then by all means, you got to check out MyBookie. Remember, who you're betting on is just as important as who you're betting with, and that's why I always tell people to go to MyBookie. Trust me, they're the best bet you'll make this season. They have been in business for years. They have great reviews online, and their mobile site is very easy to use. They have in-game live betting, over and under on fantasy points scored, and the most rewarding player perks in the business. MyBookie has been recently slammed with new bettors and wants to help you out by giving you an extra $25 free play if you deposit $100 more after 7 p.m. Eastern. Use the promo code LOCKEDON25 to activate that offer. Go ahead and visit MyBookie today. That's MyBookie. And don't forget the promo code LOCKEDON25 to get the extra $25 if you deposit after 7 p.m. You play, you win, you get paid. All right, our next question comes from Jay Halim on Twitter. He asks, during the preseason, Jacksonville was shopping Dante Fowler Jr. after an incident. Do you think that's someone the Falcons can and would go after? If so, what do you think the price would be? Possibly. You know, obviously Fowler and Dan Quinn have the Florida connection. That was the connection people made back in 2015 when he was in the draft. He wound up going ahead of where the Falcons picked. I was a big fan of Dante Fowler when he was coming out of college, but I also sort of recognized that due to some subpar testing, that he probably had a lower ceiling as a pass rusher compared to some of the other guys in that 2015 draft class. And I think that's kind of proven to be the case in the pros. I think he's sort of, you know, he's a situational pass rusher. I think if he's like your fifth or sixth best pass rusher, which I think he arguably is in Jacksonville, that's a good sign. I think if he's like your third best pass rusher, then you probably don't have a great pass rush. And I think, you know, I put sort of lump Fowler and Beasley in the similar groups. I don't necessarily know if those are going to be the guys that are going to really step up in big situations in the playoff game, going up against guys like Andrew Whitworth or Teron Armstead or Lane Johnson and be able to make those plays in those sort of crunch time situations. Looking at Fowler's production, like most of it from what I've seen has come against, similar to Beasley, has come against the lower levels of competition at the tackle spot and getting a number of cleanup sacks. So I feel like he's a one-note speed rusher similar to Beasley, but he's probably better at playing that one note in terms of bending the edge because I think he has a little bit more core or a lot more core strength that he doesn't get knocked off his rush as easily and as easily controlled as Beasley does. So I think you can certainly make a case that Dante Fowler is an upgrade. And I certainly think, you know, given the Falcons, that beggars can't be choosers, as I just discussed recently. So making a trade for him, I think, makes sense. personally, I don't know if I would give up more than a fifth round pick for him, though, just because like I probably overvalue like fourth round picks and whatnot and higher round picks. And I certainly think you can make a case that, you know, oh, Dante Fowler is better than any pass rusher you would take in the fourth round. But from my perspective, I'm like, if you're drafting pass rusher in the fourth round, like you're wasting picks. Like, you're drafting backups at that point, you know? And so, yeah, Fowler's better than a backup. But if the Falcons are realistically going to address their pass rush, they're drafting that guy in the first or second round, right? And then I'd rather just keep that fourth round pick and use it at another position to get it like a low-level starter or key reserve at like guard or linebacker or tight end, because I feel like whoever we get in the first or second round is potentially going to be better than what Dante Fowler brings to the table. And so, you know, I think the other issue with Fowler is the money, and he's a free agent after this year, and you're going to have to pay him. If you trade for him, you want to get more than, you know, what, 13 games out of him. So, especially if you're trading, you know, a mid round pick, you know, if you're drafting a fourth round pick, you know, with obviously exceptions to like guys like Sean Harlow, but your expectation when you draft a fourth round pick is you're going to get 3 or 4 years out of that guy, not 13 games. So, you know, you got to pay Fowler. I don't know what his market rate would be, but I would guess it's somewhere around the 8 million, 9 million range. That's around what Andre Branch got. That's what Bruce Irvin got, you know, maybe a little north of that. I don't necessarily know if Fowler's the type of guy that I would feel confident paying that amount of money, just because I just think he has limitations. And, you know, when you compare that cost to, say, a fourth round pick, you know, a fourth round pick is signing like a 4-year, $2.5 to $3 million contract. So he's averaging, you know, less than 1/10 of what you're going to wind up paying Fowler. You know, so I don't necessarily know if Fowler is going to give you 10 times as much value as what a typical fourth round pick would get. Maybe. So like if it's me, if I'm making a trade, right, which I've advocated, obviously, this past week on this podcast a number of times, I would prefer the Falcons to target an interior guy, because then, you know, regardless of how you feel about Vic Beasley, you can at least convince yourself that between Jarrett, that interior guy, Tack, and Vic, that's your four-man nickel rush at least through 2018 and potentially beyond if everything works out for you. But if you go out and get another edge rusher, you're kind of just swapping, particularly a guy like Fowler, you're kind of just swapping out, you know, are you swapping him out for Vic? Because how are you going to get him, Vic, and Tack on the field at the same time? Are you going to basically make Tack into a D tackle, an interior guy, which I think he can do, but right now that's not proven to be the best way of using him. So, you might be square pegging him just for what, you know? So I think the problem is with like trading for a guy like Fowler is like, you're basically swapping out, you know, if you're trading for him so he can replace Vic, you're basically kind of swapping out one overpaid underperforming edge in Beasley for a soon to be overpaid underperforming edge in Fowler. So I'm not necessarily keen on some of these edge guys that people want the Falcons to trade for. Some of them, like a guy like a Trey Flowers or a guy like a David Irving who play D-end or can play D-end but also can kick inside as pass rushers, a Preston Smith or somebody like that who did that at Mississippi State, hasn't really been asked to do that at Washington because he plays linebacker in their 3-4. But like those types of guys, I'd be much more willing, those types of edges that have, you know, lived in on the interior in previous stops are more up my speed in terms of what I'd be willing to give up, because I don't feel like you have to change what Tack is in order to accommodate that new player. You know, and the last thing I'll say about this is, while I'm certainly of the mindset of sort of letting Vic go after this season, you know, I feel like he deserves the opportunity to finish this season. And if he finishes strong, great. If he doesn't, then I think you sort of shop him in the offseason. Hopefully you can get like a third or fourth round pick. I don't think you're going to get more than that. And if you can get a third or fourth round pick for him, then I think you take it. You know, if you can't get that value for him, then I think you do what you should have done a while ago and basically turn him into a linebacker and stop pretending that he's this great pass rusher, and instead of dipping your toe into him being a linebacker, actually teach him how to be a linebacker, teach him how to drop into coverage, teach him zone coverage responsibilities, teach him how to tackle, all those sorts of things that come with being a linebacker, not just a guy that's a DN that dabbles at linebacker, which is what he has been so far in Atlanta. Because I think ultimately the issue with Vic is when you're, and this is also an issue with Fowler to a certain extent, if you're just a nickel edge rusher and you don't produce in that role, you're not contributing anything else to the team. You're not contributing anything in base defense. You're not contributing anything on special teams. And so if you're underachieving, that's part of the reason why it's so frustrating with Vic right now, because the Falcons insist, oh, we're not going to play him in the base defense. And now he's not really stepping up as a nickel guy. And so now you're like, what is he doing for us? You know, at least last year when he was dabbling at linebacker, he was doing positive stuff in the base defense, even if he wasn't necessarily setting the world on fire in the nickel. And that's another reason why I'm much more in favor of him being, you know, a linebacker, at least on base downs, than the Falcons seem to be. But for the most part, dealing with the Fowler type of trade proposal, I sort of think it's a lateral move, but maybe I'm a little lower on Fowler than other people. It doesn't necessarily move the needle for me. But before we move on, we got a couple more questions I want to answer. But I want to let you guys know that if maybe you are one of these people that Andy was referring to, that is the sky is falling and you're all ready to move on to 2019. If that's the case, then you guys should check out the Draft Dudes podcast with hosts Joe Marino and Kyle Krabs, now part of the Locked On Podcast Network. You can find them at thedraftnetwork.com. Part of the Locked On Network, your team every day. Joshua Jones asks, anything stick out why they ran the ball so poorly compared to the previous week? I don't think the blocking was good. Schweitzer really struggled in this game. I think Schrader really struggled. I think, at least in Schrader's defense, he was primarily responsible for blocking Cameron Jordan. Cameron Jordan wrecked him, as Cameron Jordan has consistently done the last several years when we've faced them. Schweitzer, on the other hand, I think was kind of getting beat by everybody. It seemed like it didn't matter who they put up against him, was Onyemata or Rankins or Stallworth or, you know, some people. I'm like, I don't even know who that dude is. Jay Bromley, you know, like some of these guys were beating him, and I'm like, what's going on, Schweitzer? You know. Tight ends did not block well either. As I said earlier, I think the Saints front just out-executed our offensive line, simple as that. Young Zach asks, what did the Saints do differently in the fourth quarter that took Ridley away? Well, they basically switched Lattimore onto him starting about midway through the third quarter. He didn't shadow him every snap, but for a good portion of the last quarter or two quarters, if you count overtime, Lattimore was covering Ridley, and that's one of the reasons why he was held in check. I think also you saw the Saints be a little bit more effective with their pressure at times in the second half, and that led to some opportunities where Matt Ryan was looking for Ridley, but he couldn't pull the trigger because pressure got to him. And I also think, you know, watching the film, there were too many instances, not necessarily specifically to Ridley, but there were too many instances where I think Matt Ryan was, you know, hesitant to pull the trigger on some tight window throws, which only get magnified in games where the Falcons lose, because you always like, man, those five throws that Matt Ryan didn't make, like, would we have won the game if he had made those, you know, three out of those five throws? Those are the questions I always have. Our last question comes from XChuck1X. He asks, please explain the science behind teams putting a player on IR. I don't know if there's much of a science to it. Obviously if a guy is out for the season, he goes on IR, which is the injured reserve for the uninitiated. If you're talking more about the short-term IR, it's basically just making a decision about a guy who's injured and his recovery time is, you know, somewhere between, you know, presumably between like a 6 to 10 week window, you know, depending on whatever that injury is. And I think the rules now are that you can bring up to two players back on short-term IR, but the rules are that they have to miss at least 8 games, and they're eligible to return to practice after 6 weeks. And then, you know, they can practice for 2 weeks and then get activated back to the roster after 8 weeks. So I guess the science is you wouldn't necessarily want to put a player on that is the diagnosis is like he's going to miss 4 to 6 weeks. just because if he only misses 4 weeks, then that means he's got to sit out four more games. And you're like, we could have been using this player. But maybe, you know, if it's a low-level player, if it's a Richard Jarvis type of player, then maybe you would do it. But then again, if Richard Jarvis gets hurt, you know, no offense to Richard Jarvis, but that type of player that's sort of, you know, the on the back end of your roster, you're just probably going to do an injury settlement, which basically, you know, the simple explanation for what an injury settlement is you just basically pay the player whatever his check is for X amount of weeks, which is usually the recovery time. But it's like it has to be at least like four. I think I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it's like it's four plus X number of weeks. And then that player is basically a free agent at that point, but typically they're injured, so they're recovering. But you can also re-sign that player after the specified time that the injury settlement lasts for. So if it's like a six-week injury settlement, then the Falcons can reach an injury settlement with that guy. Like Corey Nelson, they reached an injury settlement with. Again, I'm going to pull some numbers out just to illustrate the point because I don't know the details. But like if it's a six-week injury settlement because it's a four-week injury or something like that, then the Falcons can re-sign Corey Nelson 6 weeks from now, basically. And it's like you free up a roster spot for an injured player, but you don't necessarily have to use an injured reserve spot for an injury that's not season ending. So that's the science. I hope that that's not confusing or anything, but I don't think it's particularly scientific. It's just like, oh, that guy's out for a long time. IR him. That guy's not, keep him on the roster and we'll just wait it out. Okay. That's it, guys. Appreciate everybody from sending in their questions. And we'll be back tomorrow with a fan talk. Have a guest that I was supposed to have on June, but we got our wires crossed multiple times and we couldn't get the recording done. And so we'll finally, or knock on wood, we'll finally get that done tomorrow. So that's what you can look for to wrap up, to close out the week. I'm sure that person has assured me via email that he's got some fiery takes on sort of the disappointing state of the Falcons currently. So that should be a fun listen. And then we'll be back Monday with the rapid reaction to whatever happens in the Cincinnati Bengals game. And until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.